In the past 2 weeks, courts have struck down at least parts of voter ID laws in four different states: Wisconsin, North Carolina, Texas, Kansas. Kareem Creighton is a visiting law professor at Vanderbilt University who focuses on race and politics. Kareem says guardedly that this is all good news.
Well, in certain states like Wisconsin, the challenges that were recently found to have merit by the district court really emphasize that the workarounds, the options that the state legislature appeared to provide for people who couldn't afford to have the driver's license, weren't really practically effective. And so that even on paper, while they were options that people had available to them to get some qualifying ID, the court found that they just weren't at all the kinds of options that actually most people could take advantage of and would therefore be serious hurdles, just as much as not being able to vote at all. There are some other states, though, where, as in North Carolina, the court found that actually the intent behind the statute itself, so in its very design, that the intent was focused on limiting the ability of African Americans in that state to cast ballots. Texas, the issue was about the access largely to the Latino population. But in those cases, I think what you see that the court is saying is the legislature can't just sort of gin up an idea that there is this thing called voter fraud and use that as an avenue through which to invoke any number of restrictions that it prefers to make life more difficult for people who don't vote for them and to make life easier for those who do.
Now that, it seems to me, is the second most important takeaway in all of this, that this issue of using voter fraud to justify X, Y, and Z restrictions on voting, kind of like using national security as a way of throwing out the Constitution. The courts aren't going to be buying this. Is that something that, or a logic that we're going to see more and more of as plaintiffs attempt to redress the changes in the Voting Rights Act that many found so onerous?
Well, certainly in the cases where you saw that the state very quickly rushed through legislation, either without doing the kind of evidentiary analysis to find evidence of voter fraud, or in North Carolina's case, where the state actually went out of its way to find the different ways that African Americans disproportionately exercise their right to vote by using same-day registration or by using early voting to go and vote on Sundays with the Souls to the Polls program, to then match up those restrictions, the court in North Carolina found was very strong evidence of intentional discrimination. And so when you see circumstances that track that fact pattern, I think you will find courts doing some of the same work for intentionality. But I do think, broadly speaking, that these circumstantial cases of intentional discrimination, particularly where, as you say, there's no evidence of voter fraud being a significant problem, is likely to find its way back to the United States Supreme Court. But note that the last time the Supreme Court of the United States dealt with this issue in Crawford versus Marion County, the court didn't seem, at least from a matter of theory, troubled by the fact that the state decided in a sort of preemptory manner to prevent voter discrimination.
If you forgive me, I just want to repeat that pattern that you're talking about, because it's really important that the court identified that lawmakers in North Carolina observed what modalities African Americans were using to vote and Latinos were using to vote, and realized it was the Sunday voting and same-day registration, and made sure the restrictions that they were enacting had a greater effect or a significant effect on those voters. And that indicated intent, and then, boom, it's thrown out. That's kind of where we're at right now. And any other state attempting to do the same thing is probably going to find the same result.
That's likely to be the case. And this is one of those moments where evidence in this manner was used against the state of North Carolina. When you look at information about the way in which people vote, there's nothing wrong with that inherently. But when you find that the very restrictions you adopt very closely match all the different ways that a certain racial group tends to utilize the franchise, that just raises the specter of intentional discrimination. And the state didn't have an alternative theory that was at all credible to dissuade the court that that was the reason, that race was the reason that they adopted the particular vote participation regulations that they did.
What is the state of early voting, same-day registration, the kinds of flexibility programs that we've seen in states like Ohio and particularly some of the real battleground states that are very distinct based on gender and ethnicity.
As far as early voting is concerned, it depends upon the state that you're in about whether or not it's robust. States like Ohio, the one that you mentioned, are currently being challenged for the way in which the election officials have implemented the rules. But early voting, same-day registration, these are definitely avenues through which people who are less affluent in terms of wealth, certainly people of color, older people sometimes, utilize more often than other groups. And so the availability of these avenues certainly will have an effect on all of these populations to be able to cast their vote in large numbers or, for that matter, organize other people in their communities to vote. And so I think that's going to be crucial going forward, certainly in the fall.
Now, I'm going to take your law professor hat off for a moment here. You know, in theory, we understand what we've been talking about. But in practical terms, if I'm a 75-year-old shut-in voter in North Carolina and I want to make sure that there's no surprises for me when I go to the polls, is there any activist organization, state organization, is there any source to find out how I can make sure that I'll be able to vote on that day based on my preference and anticipate some of these restrictions that are proliferating around the country?
There are definitely a few of them out there that do the work. In North Carolina, you mentioned there definitely is an organization there that actually is located in North Carolina, the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, which is one of the groups that actually brought the challenge to North Carolina's law. You can certainly check this organization called the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights under Law, which has an election protection agency. But their election protection group is nationwide and actually gives information out no matter where you live about how you can vote, who you can call if you run into any problems at all. And the NAACP Legal Defense Fund also runs a similar group. But there are definitely many organizations out there. And I think if you are unsure at all, the best first option is to call and ask, because it may be, depending upon where you live, you are unfortunately run by a system where people aren't necessarily encouraging your ability to cast a ballot. And you have to sometimes go in armed, not just with your good common sense, but sometimes the threat of lawsuit. And to the extent that that's true, it's good to have backup with a lot of these organizations who can assist.
Based on what you've seen in the campaign so far, how much danger is there of a repeat of 2000 or some new scenario of too close to call in 2016?
Well, I think in this day and age, with the growing sophistication of both campaign technology and, frankly, the polarization of the country, it is never the case that you can dismiss the closeness of an election outcome. There's a long time between now and November. The polls now seem to be showing the Democrats with an advantage, but there's a long time with a lot of twists and turns that are almost certainly going to occur. So to the extent that state by state, the polls tighten, this becomes a reality. And more than that, it's important to note, in addition to the race for president, of course, there are any number of Senate contests and down ballot races where these margins may actually make all of the difference. So even a few votes cast or challenged at the polls may well become the subject of a lot of litigation. So I think it's quite important to be aware of what the rules are, and the work that is being done in challenging a lot of these voting rules actually can have great effect.
Are you speaking academically or from the gut here?
I think both, actually.
So you're a little worried.
I think any time that people who want to cast a ballot are not permitted, even though they are legally entitled to do so, I'm worried. That's a personal commitment of mine. I think it's a commitment that we should all value as Americans. And as such, I think it's important for us to get this right. You know, we're 16 years from the last time we had, I think, the meltdown that everybody now recognizes is a pretty significant frailty in our system. 2016 could well be the test to figure out how much we've learned since then. The courts can be helpful in that regard, but I think it's important before we even get to court that we have citizens and, frankly, organizations out there working hard to make sure that the elected officials out there do their jobs and help us get this all right.
Professor Kareem Creighton is a visiting professor of law at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. He also runs a policy consulting firm. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.